This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place with your host, Craig Danieloff.
A Complete Unknown is based on a book by Elijah Wald, who wrote Dylan Goes Electric, Newport, Seeger, Dylan, and the Night That Split the 60s. As its title suggests, the book looks at the events of this period based on Seeger and his role in the established folk music scene, Dylan's arrival and ascension, and the dramatic events that took place at Newport in 1965. That structure is what Mangold and Jay Cox used to create the script, which is informed by, but not entirely faithful to, many of the details as told in the book itself. By the way, the path that this project took and how it came to be is quite interesting. It actually started within Dylan's office, who was working on getting something made as early as 2018. If you're curious about the backstory, check the show notes for links to a great podcast with one of the producers and separately to a print interview with Elijah Wald where he talks about his involvement. But it's the facts behind the events included in the movie that we're interested in here today. And since Wald is the guy who did the research and wrote the book, he knows a lot about this period of Dylan's life, about Pete Seeger and the folk movement, about Suze and Joan and all the people who were around, and perhaps most importantly, about what happened at Newport in 65. The book is more of a true story than the movie, which is why a lot of us are picking it up to read or reread, having enjoyed the movie version. Well, this past week, a Dylan friend named Stu Levitan let it be known that he had interviewed Wald about all of this on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of Newport 65 for his show Books and Beats with Stu Levitan, which was originally broadcast on 92.1 FM, The Mic, in Madison, Wisconsin. Stu was generous enough to give permission for me to share this interview here on Dylan FM. And so, here you go. A 45-minute dive into the actual history of Seeger and Dylan and Going Electric at Newport 65. Enjoy.
Welcome back to Books and Beats with Stu Levitan. In a moment, we'll continue our conversation with Elijah Wald. His book, Dylan Goes Electric, Newport, Seeger, Dylan, and the Night That Split the 60s. Because 50 years ago last night, this happened. You thought they were all in you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging. Not the most ferocious version of Like a Rolling Stone Bob Dylan has ever performed, but in the context, it blew people's minds. A song of alienation and isolation in the midst of a collectivist fantasy of folk songs and folk singers. Not singer-songwriters, but folk songs. It was a remarkable moment in the 60s. Elijah Wald says it's the night that split the 60s. His new book is Dylan Goes Electric, Newport, Seeger, Dylan, and the Night That Split the 60s. It all happened 50 years ago last night, July 25th, 1965. The song, Like a Rolling Stone, the single had been released about a week before, so some people had heard it, but nobody was prepared to see it live. here's more with Elijah Wald, author of Dylan Goes Electric, Newport Seeger, Dylan, and the Night That Split the 60s. So how hard was it to put together an accurate account of what people actually heard that night?
You know, that's going to be a hard one to answer, because what I can tell you is what I came up with. How accurate it is, all I can say is it's the best I could do. There is the advantage that there are unedited audio tapes. You can listen to everything. And despite what I just said, they picked up a fair amount. I mean, you hear quite a bit of yelling from the audience, and you can hear what people are saying, and some of them are clearly very angry with Dylan, and some of them clearly think he's absolutely wonderful. I mean, you hear people yelling on both sides. I've talked to a lot of people. I mean, you know, obviously there were 17,000 people there, so there are plenty of witnesses. I was lucky to come up with some very close to primary source documents. Obviously, there are all the newspaper reviews, but also a number of people wrote down their thoughts at the time, and also by pure chance, I was fabulously lucky and found an 18-year-old woman who had kept a very thorough scrapbook of her Newport weekend, complete with pictures by her boyfriend, and that was, you know, that was sort of gold, because it gave a very immediate sense of how it felt at the time. And as it happens, she's one of the people who was really upset at what Dylan was doing.
Are there things about that weekend you still don't know?
Of course.
Do you know what they are?
There are things about, you know, there are things about what I did yesterday that I probably don't know. Are there mysteries that I wish someone would clear up for me? You know, there are some specific, there are some things I know I don't know, which is a slightly different question. One of the few things that was not caught completely on tape was Alan Lomax gave a rather insulting introduction to the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, and I'm not sure exactly why, but that's one of the very few moments that only part of it was caught on tape, so I know that I'm missing something there. But, you know, the problem with any project like this is that, you know, you don't know what you don't have.
And just to clear up one of the many myths and misconceptions, it was over that introduction, not over anything related to Dylan, that Lomax and Albert Grossman came to roly-poly blows.
Pretty much everybody agrees on that. Yeah, I think we can say that's a fact.
Take us to the world of Bob Dylan in July 1965. Was he a folk singer? Was he a pop star? Was he a song and dance man?
You know, it depends who you ask. Dylan, and this is something people keep leaving out of this story, Dylan's idea of folk music is a very traditionalist idea. He considers folk music to be those old ballads that people used to sing, you know, back in the countryside.
World Gone Wrong and this...
That even was a relatively modern blues song. No, Barbara Allen.
Well, I mean, the kind of songs that were on those two albums.
Some of those. Yeah. But, I mean, some of those were relatively pop blues, specifically
okay.
That one.
Okay.
But, yeah, old songs. And he very specifically began saying, I'm not a folk singer anymore, when he became a singer-songwriter. And there's, in fact, this wonderful quote I found that he wrote in 1964, that he just scribbled on the back of It Ain't Me, Babe. His, you know, he wrote that on the stationery in the Mayfair Hotel in London. And on the back he wrote, how many times do I have to say I am not a folk singer before people will stop saying he's not a folk singer? That's where he was on that. The other place he was on that, I mean, there was a lot happening at that moment. He was clearly switching over into playing electric music. He wanted hits. Let's remember, Dylan made his first electric single in 1962 and released it before Freewheeling. They just didn't put it on the album because it didn't work. The time wasn't right. It had pretty much the same band that was on Maggie's Farm, and the lead guitarist even played similar licks. But the time was, you know, that wasn't what people were ready for just then. And by the time the Animals and the Rolling Stones had arrived doing Dylan imitations, Dylan figured, okay, you know, time for me to jump on this one. The other thing that was happening is the times were changing in other ways. I'm sorry to say the times, they were changing in other ways. You know, this was the moment when the folk scene, the let's all join arms and sing Blowing in the Wind or We Shall Overcome in support of the civil rights movement down south, was ending and was really being replaced by that individualist resistance to the war in Vietnam, grow your hair, dress differently, take drugs, turn on, tune in, drop out. I'm not saying this is true of everybody, but there really was a shift from we want to be part of that movement of Pete and Woody and the union songs to don't trust anybody over 30. And, you know, when I call subtitle this book The Night That Split the 60s, I'm not suggesting that Dylan was the cause, but he was the marker of a huge split.
Was Newport the moment when rock and roll collided with folk and created rock? Not folk rock, which pre-existed, but actually created rock?
I'm not going to say there's a single moment. I mean, as I just was saying, I mean, the Animals, you know, I mean, the Animals had already done House of the Rising Sun. And the Rolling Stones had done Satisfaction, which is a clear Dylan imitation, and Mick Jagger was the first person to say that. So, you know, those worlds had been pretty colliding for, you know, as I say, Alan Lomax was saying rock and roll is America's true folk music. So it's, you know, I hear what you're saying. I mean, definitely there's a change to this thing called rock. And certainly it's the moment of a generation that would have said, we like folk music, we don't like rock, rock is teenage music, saying rock speaks for us in a way that folk music didn't. It certainly is the moment for that.
You mentioned the subtitle, which is Newport, Seeger, Dylan, and the Night That Split the 60s. Why is Pete Seeger important in this narrative?
Partly because there are few kinds of music that you can personify with one person the way Pete Seeger personified the folk scene of the late 50s and early 60s. I mean, there is no strain of that scene, from Dylan to the Kingston Trio to the string band revival to the pop folkies and to the political singers and Phil Oaks, all of that came directly out of Pete Seeger. He was one of the most amazingly influential figures in American music, and that's easy to forget because his records don't really reflect it, and we tend to do music history through records. I mean, Pete Seeger was the quintessential live performer, and it's very, very hard to explain to anyone who never saw him on stage what it was that he did, because it's just not captured on vinyl.
As a deadhead, I know that feeling.
Yeah, okay, sure.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, once you've seen the Dead a bunch of times, then you can listen to the tapes and they remind you of what that thing is. But if you were never in that room, people listen to the tapes and go, why were you excited about this? They're just going on and on.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Seeger, it's a different thing. It's, why are you getting excited about this? His singing isn't that great. His banjo playing isn't that great. What's the point? You had to be there. But if you were there, it changed your life, you know?
Another one of the enduring myths is that Pete Seeger either threatened or tried or wanted to cut the sound cables with an axe. Apparently, this is so enduring a myth that Pete thought he had said it himself, even though he never did, all because Peter Yarrow used a hipster's term for a guitar?
That's my answer. But, you know, when I came across that, just so people understand what we're talking about, yeah, there's this moment after Dylan has left the stage for the rock set, before he is persuaded to come back on with an acoustic guitar. And Pete Seeger was absolutely furious and was really, you know, he was raging around, he was pulling at wires, and that I have several people saying. And there's a moment where he was actually out at the side of the stage, and you can hear it on the tape, George Ween saying, "Pete, leave that alone." And just at that moment, Peter Yarrow was center stage and said, referring to Dylan going to get his acoustic guitar, "He's going to get his axe." And most people in those days didn't know that you called the guitar an axe. Some people obviously did, but some people clearly got confused and thought he was talking about Seeger and that he was going to get an axe.
Who, in fact,
or just wondered if he might have been. I mean, who knows how that one spread?
Well, and in fact, Pete Seeger had done songs there, work songs with an axe, chopping wood and singing songs. So it would have made sense.
And he was well known for doing that. Yeah, absolutely. Seeger regularly carried an axe on stage and chopped as part of his act. There had been a Texas work gang chopping logs on the stage the previous night. Pete had done it at a workshop the previous afternoon. So when everybody heard that story, everybody who knew Pete well went, "Well, I mean, he does, in fact, carry an axe a lot of the time." Yeah, no, it all made sense in a weird way.
You found
that's how folklore happens, you know?
You found a fan who actually saw Seeger at breakfast the next morning tell Pete Seeger, "I thought he had so much promise."
Boy, yeah, once in a while you get lucky. Yeah, this guy just came up to me. I was, you know, obviously soliciting information, and I went to Indian Neck, which is sort of the gathering of the old folkies. It's actually, I think, the first place that Dylan played outside New York after coming to New York. He went to the Indian Neck Folk Festival in 60 or 61. And I went there a couple of years ago, and I went on stage, actually, and said, you know, if anybody was there and has memories, please tell me. And somebody came up and told me that story, and it was just like, oh, my God, there's the end of my chapter.
Mm-hmm. In his private notes, Seeger called Dylan's performance some of the most destructive music this side of hell.
Yep.
That's pretty harsh.
Well, you know, it felt that way to him. And as I said, that was not just about Dylan. That was about, you know, this was a moment where everything he had built was falling apart. I mean, he and his whole generation of folk fans, keep in mind that they had had their moment where they had tried to make folk music the voice of sort of the left in the 40s, and it never really caught on, and then the McCarthy era hit, and people, you know, went to jail and had their careers destroyed. And then in the early 60s, the civil rights movement started doing exactly what Seeger had dreamed of. I mean, Seeger was the guy who had taught everybody "We Shall Overcome," and suddenly it was the anthem of the country. And everybody was marching arm in arm, and a lot of people felt like a new world was really right around the corner, and they really could change things, and the world was getting to be a better place. And suddenly, Dylan comes on stage in what had sort of been, for Seeger, the incubator of that spirit, and essentially gave a set saying, "To hell with all of you." I mean, it was an aggressive set. It was a set where he's going out there saying, "How does it feel to be all alone?" Yeah, I understand why Seeger was upset. I also understand why Dylan felt like Seeger's dream did not include him and he needed to say something else. I'm not taking sides. I just, you know, and let's be fair, it was true. I mean, the folk movement, you know, somebody recently wrote in response to someone reviewing my book in The Guardian, they said, you know, what he's saying isn't right. The folk movement was dead when the Beatles went on the Ed Sullivan Show. That's not a bad date either. But, you know, either way you frame it, it was the apocalypse for the people who thought folk music was going to be the music of America's youth.
How did Newport and Seeger's reaction to Dylan affect Seeger's reputation?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I'd never really thought about till I was doing this book, and I suddenly realized, you know, people talk like Dylan's reputation changed that night, but what changed that night was Seeger's reputation. Seeger had been a rebel. He'd been the voice of the left, of rebellion, of going your own way, and after that night, he was the voice of respectability and conservatism and the old guard and the older people who they might be very nice in their way, but they couldn't understand the youth. And that, you know, I don't want to overstate it. There were plenty of young people who still loved Seeger, but he never had, you know, there was never again a moment where anyone thought of Seeger as being on the cutting edge.
And here's a man who was in contempt of Congress and facing jail time for his integrity.
Well, it's crazier than that. Here's a man who, while Dylan could get on television, Seeger couldn't because he was still blacklisted. And, I mean, I actually ran into somebody. He's a friend of mine who, when I started talking about this book, he said, you know, I got thrown off my high school band in 1968 for attending a Pete Seeger concert, three of us. We went to the Pete Seeger concert, and the band leader threw us out of the band for going to see that communist.
Do you know if Dylan and Seeger ever talked seriously with each other about that night?
I have no idea. I do know that they remained, to some extent, you know, I mean, both of them were intensely shy and guarded men. They did meet any number of times after that, have dinner together, talk with each other on the phone. I have no reason to think they talked about that night, but I don't know.
We talked about some of the what-ifs. Did the shock of Newport, the erratic sound, the unexpected nature of it, just the assaultive nature of it, did that create the narrative that then played out at Forest Hills the next month and then on the fall tour? Could it all have been different if those first shows had been smooth? Would all that booing over the next year and a half have happened?
That's one of the big questions, and I think it's a very, very fair question. I mean, the booing at Newport instantly became part of the folklore of the pop music world, and I think it's perfectly possible that no one would have booed Dylan on the rest of that tour if people hadn't been primed by Newport. On the other hand, who knows? But no, I think that's a very reasonable question. And Peter Yarrow asks an even more interesting question. Peter Yarrow thinks if Dylan had gone on at Newport, sung an acoustic song or two acoustic songs, and then said, I'd like you to hear what I'm working on now. I know it's a little bit different, but I hope you appreciate it. And then did exactly the same electric set, whether everybody wouldn't have embraced it with open arms. Very possible.
So is there a straight line between the teenage Bobby Zimmerman and the Shadow Blasters getting jeered in high school and that night in Newport 8 years later?
I think so, absolutely. I think there are two straight lines. One of them is that Dylan was always a rock and roller, and, you know, there's the period when Dylan was singing political folk songs. I mean, people tell the story like he was first singing political folk songs and then went into rock and roll. And one of the weird things I found when I did the book is that, you know, his first album, I never noticed that the guitar part to Highway 51 was Wake Up Little Susie by the Everly Brothers. And to show you how dumb that makes me, it says so in the liner notes. And also the liner notes say that among his heroes are Carl Perkins and early Elvis Presley. I mean, it was all right there in the early Dylan that he was a rock and roller. And then there's a point, maybe a year and a half, when he makes this sort of turn into singing political folk music. And then he's going back to doing other stuff and is playing boogie-woogie piano with a Jerry Lee Lewis glissando, as well as writing Mr. Tambourine Man. I mean, he was, as he is now, he was an extremely varied artist. But yeah, there's that straight line, but there's also the straight line of, you know, his girlfriend in high school says they were jeering and booing him, and it didn't seem to bother him a bit. And that also is true. You know, he seems straight through to have thrived on the fact that some people loved what he did and some people hated it. He seems to have always taken pride in the fact that he excited strong emotions both ways.
on the point of his origins and his early career, another point you make that's something that most people forget if they even remember knew it at one point is that everyone understands his transcendent genius as a songwriter now, but they forget he was signed as a singer and musician. He wasn't a songwriter at all.
Not only that, but he was the first male, I mean, there was the bias thing happening, but of all the male singers in New York or Cambridge or anywhere else, he was the first one signed to a major label before he was a songwriter. Yeah, no, he was, a lot of people recognized as soon as they saw him that he was something different. And the way a number of them described it was he sang folk music with rock and roll energy.
The origin myth of his getting signed brings us to Robert Shelton, a name well known as the writer for the New York Times, who jump-started Bob's career with those first very enthusiastic reviews. But he also used some other names, apparently, apparently crossing from journalism to promotion.
Yeah, no, that was one of the things that I had not expected and that I found very, very interesting. And, you know, trying not to hit it too hard, but it does keep cropping up in fascinating ways. Yes, he was Robert Shelton writing for the New York Times. He was Stacey Williams writing the liner notes to Dylan's first album. He was Stacey Williams editing the program for the 1963 Newport Folk Festival. And then he was Robert Shelton, Dylan's biographer, saying Dylan's picture was everywhere at the folk festival, the main example being that it was the lead picture in the program that he had edited. Yeah.
Well, it makes communication efficient if you can control both sides of the message.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, he's interesting because he also is sort of a bellwether for how things were shifting. I mean, I quote two different pieces he wrote, one for his own magazine, Hootenanny Magazine, and one just a few months later for the Newport Folk Festival brochure, and the first is his first reaction to the Beatles, which is, this could ruin everything we love. And he actually goes so far as to compare them negatively to the Kingston Trio and say, yeah, I never really liked the Kingston Trio, but at least they're taking people towards the good music, and the Beatles are taking us toward the bad music. And then by 1965, I mean, one of the odd things about people saying, you know, the Newport Folk Festival hated rock and roll, they weren't ready. Robert Shelton has an article in the Folk Festival program in 1965 saying we need to open our ears and listen to the Supremes and the Beatles and the Love and Spoonful, not just this old folk music. We need to be ready. You know, we need to open ourselves up to this stuff as well. So it was very much the zeitgeist, and he was very much there.
Given the impact of that appearance on the festival and on traditional folk music itself, is this celebration appropriate, or is it deeply ironic?
I suppose it's both. No, I think it's mostly appropriate, honestly, because what Dylan did that night... you know, its importance in its moment is very, I think, was really in only a small way musical. I think in terms of what he has done musically, he very much is sort of a guiding spirit. I think if you probably asked all the bands playing Newport this year who their biggest influences were, he's the name you would find most often. So that he should be viewed that way doesn't seem weird to me at all.
But when I read in your book that Alan Lomax said he killed the festival and George Wein said he killed the festival, did he kill the festival?
George Wein didn't say he killed the festival. George Wein said something quite different, which was that the world was changing, the Beatles were coming in, and Dylan's appearance playing rock and roll sort of gave all the kids who were torn between being folkies and listening to the fun music their friends were listening to permission to say, okay, I guess we can listen to the fun music. And that after that, Newport was still a wonderful festival, but it was a festival of old music, not the place where everything was happening. And that's, I think, a completely fair assessment. Alan's assessment was, as was the normal with Alan, a little over the top.
Yeah, Alan, we can talk a bit about Alan and some of the...
You know, one of the things to understand about Alan is he was over the top in all kinds of directions. I mean, one of the things that fascinated me when I actually did serious research on this is that the first night of that weekend in 1965, the Chambers brothers did this blazing electric set, after which Alan Lomax jumped on stage and said, "I am truly proud that tonight the Newport Folk Festival has finally acknowledged America's true modern folk music, rock and roll."
So why the introduction of the Butterfield Blues Band was so snarky?
Because the Butterfield Blues Band, look, Alan Lomax was the man who first found Muddy Waters in Mississippi, and whose recordings inspired Muddy Waters to go to Chicago and think he could make a living in music. Alan Lomax was very, very, very deep in electric Chicago blues, and he was, I think a lot of people, including Michael Bloomfield, would have agreed with him if he simply said, "I'm really upset that the first full-scale Chicago blues band Newport has invited is not Buddy Guy or Muddy Waters or Magic Sam or Howling Wolf. It's a bunch of white kids who have been invited because their record company thinks that they could be the next big thing." And that was the sort of thing that made Alan very, very upset, unlike inviting a bunch of young black rock and rollers from Mississippi and L.A. who were playing the latest sounds from their world. I'm not saying I agree with him about all of that, but I understand why it made him upset. And honestly, Michael Bloomfield or Paul Butterfield would have felt the same way if it hadn't been specifically them and a situation that could potentially change their lives, which it did.
Of course, the fact that it was Butterfield and Bloomfield proved incredibly fortuitous, because Bob Dylan did not come to Newport with a rock and roll band, but hooked up with, right, Al Kooper, the core of Butterfield's band, apparently on the spur of the moment.
Yep.
So
it seems very, very clear that nobody knew this was coming. If anyone had known it was coming, they would have had a chance to rehearse. And I, you know, honestly, if they'd had a chance to rehearse and had hit the stage and played a tight, perfect set, who knows how much of the story might be different?
Well, that's the question. I mean, first of all, if Butterfield hadn't been there, none of this would have happened. That if Dylan had,
right,
hooked up, if he hadn't hooked up at Newport, then the electric debut would have been in August at Forest Hills. Without that psychic overlay of "this is the Newport Folk Festival," the whole thing would have been different.
Absolutely. And if he had gone on at Newport even and done what he did at Forest Hills, which was to first play a bunch of acoustic music and then bring out the band, you know, he learned after Newport that that's the way you do it. So there, you know, there are a lot of what might have beens, which, you know, frankly, there always are when you look at history.
And when you look at how charismatic and captivating a performer Dylan had been in the coffee houses just a few years before, to see this insular, isolated, non-communicative force in the black leather jacket, if he had only remembered that performer, that little tramp performer, and had brought the audience in, it might have gone down differently.
There are all sorts of ways it could have gone down differently. And, you know, speaking as somebody who arrived to this party a bit later than that, it's not that he was less magnetic a performer when he became the silent guy in the black leather jacket. He was a very differently magnetic performer.
Speaking of arriving late, you were six when all this happened. What do you remember about becoming aware of Dylan at Newport?
Boy, you know, probably Dylan at Newport, I would have become aware of, I don't know, it would have been considerably later. It might even have been seeing the movie Festival, which I didn't see until the mid-70s. I mean, I don't remember Dylan at Newport being a huge thing for me, because, as you say, I was a kid. I didn't yet know who Dylan was.
Speaking of the movie Festival, we all know that memories are unreliable. I was very dismayed to learn from your book that even the video documentation itself has been edited to reinforce a particular narrative.
Yeah. You know, to be fair, they were left with a pretty complicated problem because the microphones on stage were the same microphones they were using for recording. And normally speaking, they were picking up quiet acoustic instruments and also a lot of crowd noise, so that when a band finished, you heard this wave of applause. But when Dylan came out with a full-scale electric band, they had to turn everything way down. And that means that when he finishes, you basically can't hear the crowd. So I can't really blame anyone for dubbing in the applause or booing or other reactions from other moments in the set. But that is what happened.
50 years ago last night, Bob Dylan blew everybody away, going electric, played three songs. The crowd, very confused. Some were happy, some were upset. Everyone wanted him to sing some more and to sing some acoustic. Came back at Peter Yarrow's and George Ween's urging and gave one of the classic kiss-offs.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you'd better grab it fast. He understands your orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun. Look out, the saints are coming through, and it's all over now, baby blue.
Here's the conclusion of our conversation with Elijah Wald, author of Dylan Goes Electric, Newport, Seeger, Dylan, and The Night That Split the 60s. You obviously knew a lot about Dylan and Newport before you started on the book. What were some of the most interesting things you learned in your research?
You know, the first thing was I had never understood quite how much of a blues musician he was. There were a couple of things. I was fascinated to find that he had, I would almost call it a fixation on black folk singers early on. I mean, he has talked often about Odetta, but, you know, I started sort of looking at his early tapes and saying, so where could these things come from? And find, you know, that, like, there's one tape where he has six songs off a Leon Bibb album. Nobody remembers Leon Bibb. But, you know, he was... And his friends back in Hibbing say this, you know, he was fascinated with black culture, so I didn't know that. And then when he gets to New York, he really immersed himself in blues, and I had never listened to, and I found fascinating, the outtakes, the unreleased stuff from what turned into Freewheeling. And so I had not understood that Freewheeling started out as a follow-up to his first album with three Robert Johnson songs, And he was getting better and better. I mean, I think it's terrific stuff. And then he wrote Blowing in the Wind, and everything changed. So, you know, that was new for me. I have to say, quite outside of the book, another thing that was new for me was as I immersed myself in Dylan sort of as a roots musician, I had never really realized... I'd never listened seriously to Love and Theft, and, you know, some of his roots albums from the late 90s, early 2000s. And part of this project that was exciting for me was discovering how much I liked those records, which very much to me now feel like the continuation of what he was doing before, you know, in a sense, the continuation of where he was headed at the beginning of Freewheeling.
Has your understanding of what Newport meant changed over the years?
You know, I don't think I understood what Newport meant until I did this project. I mean, I had always thought of Newport in terms of... I started out as a blues fan. So when I dreamed of being at Newport, my dream was, oh my God, I could have seen Skip James and Mississippi John Hurt and Booker White and Son House and all these people. And I never really had thought about the bigger idea of Newport and the idea, you know, first of all, I didn't know that Pete Seeger invented Newport, Pete Seeger and his wife Toshi. That, I mean, it was their idea to create the kind of festivals that were created, and their idea was, if everybody works for $50 and we can get the popular stars to come and do that, we can make a festival that's mostly made up of real folk, authentic folk musicians from the countryside who nobody's ever heard of. And they put together these festivals that I never thought of this way, because, of course, once they appeared at Newport, everybody had heard of them. So by the time I'm coming on board, I'm going, oh, my God, they have, and the, you know, the names I just named you. But nobody had ever heard those names until they appeared at Newport. So I didn't really understand it at all. Or the amount of the civil rights singing that was there. You know, the extent to which the Freedom Singers, Fannie Lou Hamer, Guy Carawan, a name that I, as you know from reading the book, I give him a fairly prominent place. And he was someone I'd even met, but I'd never really thought about.
Who just passed away.
Who just passed away, yeah.
So of all the pivotal events in the narrative, from Pete Seeger's debut on a bill with Woody Guthrie in 1940 to Dylan's doings 25 years later, what are some of the events that you would have most liked to have witnessed?
Again, we have to come to my personal taste. There's a fascinating concert that I never even heard about. You have to understand, Dave Van Ronk was my mentor. He was almost a second father to me, and that he never told me about this blows my mind. About a month before Newport in 65, where Dylan went electric, and we hear of it as, you know, the first moment of rock and folk intersecting, they had the first and only New York Folk Festival, and Dave Van Ronk booked the opening night. He called it the birth of funk or something like that. And the lineup was Van Ronk, Eric Von Schmidt, Mississippi John Hurt, Sun House, Mose Allison, the Muddy Waters Blues Band, and Chuck Berry. And I read that lineup, and that's the night I most would have liked to see. I don't know how it went in real life, but, I mean, Sing Out magazine gave it a good review. What a lineup. But any of the Newport festivals, I mean, you know, for someone, as you point out, I was born in 1959. I mean, I grew up, the list of people I wish I could have seen, but I was too young to see them live. An awful lot of them were at Newport in those, in 63, 64, 65, 66.
Speaking of Sing Out, I think the first thing, the moment I realized I was going to learn a lot from this book was when I realized, oh my goodness, the title Sing Out came from the chorus of the Hammer song.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that either. Isn't it crazy that we didn't think of that?
It's like, oh yeah, I get that. That makes sense, yeah.
You know, that's an interesting point because, you know, I have, because of a couple of other books I've written, and I admit complete complicity in this. You know, I titled the book How the Beatles Destroyed Rock and Roll. I understand why people think of me as a contrarian. But, you know, what I'm really looking for is moments like that, where I hit something that I'd never thought of, I'd never seen written anywhere, and it instantly, you just go, oh yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that was one of those moments.
Finally, that night at Newport made history. Did it affect the future?
Yeah, I guess. Who knows? I mean, certainly everything that happened in the future happened after that.
That goes without saying, I guess.
Yeah.
It
affected the future, you know, it more than the average butterfly wing in the Amazon, yeah. As much as the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, I don't know. You know, there are a lot of big moments.
It was a remarkable night in Newport, July 25th, 1965, the night that Bob Dylan went electric. Elijah Wald has written a very insightful and excellent analysis of it called Dylan Goes Electric, Newport Seeger Dylan and the Night That Split the 60s from our friends at Day Street Press. Elijah, I want to thank you for the decades of great analysis and writing, this wonderful new book, and for the time you took to talk about it with us here today.
Sure, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm going to make my way down to Atwood Fest. I hope to see you there. And then to Dave Adler's 50 Shades of Dave at the High Noon Saloon. Back next week with an all-new episode of Books and Beats with Stu Levitan on Madison's Progressive Talk, The Mic, 92.1.
Our thanks to Stu Levitan for sharing that interview and to Elijah Wald. Reminder that the book is available just about everywhere. We'll put links to it in the show notes. Please check out other shows on Dylan FM. This is part of a new series we're doing called Not Completely Unknown. That's kind of an introduction to Dylan for people who may be catching up or getting interested again after the movie. But there's about 75 other shows here talking about many of Dylan's albums with interviews with authors and all kinds of deep dives into Bob Dylan, which we do here and on our Substack. Check out all the links in the show notes.
Did you enjoy this show? Then please rate this podcast and leave a review. It really helps. And take a moment to follow this podcast so you don't miss upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening.